In 1961, a young psychologist at Yale University named Stanley Milgram began a series of obedience experiments in which participants were asked to administer electric shocks to someone in the next room whenever he answered a question incorrectly. They were told that they were participating in a study of the effects of pain on learning. But with World War II and the Holocaust still fresh in people's minds, his results were interpreted to show that we are all capable of cruelty due to obedience to authority. The study caused a worldwide sensation, mostly on ethical grounds, but Milgram's findings have rarely been challenged. Now, in Behind the Shock Machine, the untold story of the notorious Milgram psychology experiments, psychologist Gina Perry uses newly revealed information to show what Milgram's experiments really revealed. It's published by the New Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Gina Perry to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How did he first go about setting up the experiment back in 1961?
The first thing he did was get the materials ready in his laboratory at Yale. So he built an elaborate machine. He recruited staff, so one person to play the role of the experimenter and one to play the person who was going to be in pain. And then when he had his script and his props and all his arrangements ready, he advertised in the New Haven Register for people who might be interested to come and do an experiment about memory and learning.
Did he look for certain types of people, or was anyone, in this case, at the beginning anyway, anyone male acceptable?
Anyone male, aged between 20 and 50, who wasn't a journalist, a policeman, or an employee of Yale.
And they were volunteers? They weren't paid?
They were paid $4.50 for their participation in the experiment, and they received that money when they arrived at the lab.
How many participated in the experiments
in total, 780.
Wow, a lot. Which would make it a respectable experiment.
Yes. The conclusions we've drawn, though, from that 780 are very misleading, though.
And we'll get to that. Okay. Why did he choose to exclude women in the early stages of the experiment?
I think it was probably because Yale at that time was male only. It was very much an experiment about the behaviour of men during wartime. And although Milgram did include one variation with a small group of women, I think that was much more of an afterthought.
Just to see what would happen if you included women in the experiment. Well, did they turn out to have similar results?
They did, and I think that also strengthened the conclusions that he drew, because he could then argue that it was applied to both genders. It made the results more powerful.
What would the experiment have looked like for the participants?
When the participants arrived at the lab, as I said, they thought they were arriving to take part in an experiment about memory and learning. So they would be met at the lab by a man in a lab coat, who introduced himself, and there would be a second volunteer waiting there who had arrived a little bit earlier.
And you say that they were actually actors.
Yes.
Why actors? First, why actors? And then second, wouldn't teaching assistants have done the job just as well?
Why actors? I think Milgram really wanted people who were able to fit the bill when it came to looking and speaking like the characters they were playing. And he did have a young research assistant at that time who he considered for a while, including in the experiment, but he decided he wasn't authoritative enough.
Were the actors following a script, or did they improvise?
Initially they followed a tightly controlled script. Certainly the learner's script was very much standardized, and so he would complain and cry out according to different points in the experiment. The experimenter did have a script as well, but I found in listening to a lot of the audio tapes of the experiments that his adherence to that script varied widely from one person to another.
So that they could adjust the results, which we will also get to in a moment.
Yes.
What were the subjects told to do?
When they arrived, they were introduced to the second person and told that each of them would draw lots for the role of teacher and learner. And always the person who was the real volunteer, the person who'd answered the ad in the newspaper, always got the piece of paper that said teacher. And so the teacher would be taken into the lab and seated in front of the machine, and the experimenter would explain that the teacher was going to teach the learner some pairs of words like red hat, blue sky, green apple. And the learner's job was to recall the pairs of words. Each time the learner got those pairs wrong, the teacher had to administer an electric shock. And with each wrong answer, the experimenter instructed the teacher to increase the voltage level on the machine.
Were the people who participated in the experiment told afterwards that the shocks were not real and that nobody got hurt?
They were eventually, but certainly not 75% of them were not told immediately after the experiment was over that it was a hoax. They had to wait until August 1962 to receive that information.
Why was it withheld?
I think that it was withheld for a couple of reasons. One was New Haven is a small town, and I think Milgram wanted to keep news of the experiment very quiet. And he thought if he debriefed people, that word would spread and it would be harder for him to find people who were what he would term naive. And secondly, I think that he probably felt that his role was, it was more important at that point to help people feel better about what they'd done.
And well, how did they react to learning that it was a hoax?
Some were very relieved. I've seen their notes on a questionnaire that they sent back to Milgram after they received the news. And one man talked about how he'd checked the obituary notices in the local newspaper for some time after the experiment because he was so concerned about the learner with the heart problem. So some people were very relieved, some people were very angry, and others felt that their own suspicions had been confirmed.
My guest is Gina Perry. Her book, Behind the Shock Machine, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments. It's published by the New Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. According to Milgram's results, what percentage of people went to the maximum voltage?
Well, we need to be clear here that we're talking, the common belief about Milgram's experiments is that the majority of people will go to maximum voltage. That was based on 65% of people in Milgram's first experiment, which involved 40 subjects. So we have this conflation of statistics from 24 different experiments into one false conclusion.
Well, how does the official story deviate from what you have learned from your research and interviews?
Well, you've already mentioned one of them, which was I was very surprised to find that people weren't debriefed immediately after the experiment was over, because one of the biggest criticisms at the time the experiments were first published was that Milgram had been careless with the welfare of his subjects, and he was quite insistent that he'd been very careful about that. So that surprised
me. Even though a man had a heart condition.
Yes. That surprised me. And I do have to say that when I began this research, I certainly did not expect that I would be revisiting the well-known story of the experiments. I thought we knew everything we needed to know. So the second thing I found that really surprised and troubled me, I suppose, was that people did write to Milgram afterwards with very specific evidence of why they were suspicious about the experiment being a hoax. Now, in a questionnaire that Milgram sent out to his subjects after the experiment was over, he dismissed people who said that they were suspicious because he said, well, people will always say that after something they feel badly about.
Well, they thought it might have been a hoax, but did anyone challenge his results? Because the results were interpreted as saying something about human nature.
Well, if you dismiss subjects' point of view, that is, you say that, well, their suspicions about the experiment are a form of denial, then you don't take them seriously. So the other thing is the experiment is based on that hoax. It's a bit like a house of cards. You have to believe that people, 100% of people who took part, believed that the experiment as it was happening was real. As soon as you challenge that, it makes the figures look very rubbery. And people were, as I said, very specific. They noticed very specific details that fed their suspicions.
Did anyone notice that Milgram had structured the test to prove a thesis?
Do you mean any of his subjects or any of his critics?
Well, critics. The subjects were just, I guess, they believed they'd been through this thing, and all they could tell was what they knew, but people looking at what Milgram was publishing, did they say, you know, this looks like, to me like he structured this to prove a point, which is something that scientists sometimes do, but of course is unacceptable within scientific research.
Yes, some early critics in Orne and Holland particularly, and other critics like Donald Mixon, also noted that the experiment was very much about, well, I think, as you say, scientists do wear particular blinkers at times, and I think Milgram was very intent on demonstrating in his lab what he believed had happened in Nazi Germany. And, you know, the Eichmann trial was very fresh in people's minds. It had been televised in America, and so people were very aware of that issue at the time. And as you know, Eichmann's defence was that he was a cog in a bureaucratic machine. So
he was just following orders.
Yes, yes. And I think Milgram was desperate and wanting very much to take part in that conversation about what had happened and why. So that kind of drive also, I think, can blinker you at times and perhaps force you to tune out information that you should pay more attention to.
But most of the concerns, the negative concerns, were about the ethics of the experiment rather than whether the experiments had been conducted correctly.
That's right. So until recently, we've only had Milgram's view of the experiments to rely on. He's written journal articles about his research, and in 1974, he published his book, Obedience to Authority, which described the experiments in detail. But there are a lot of things left out of that material that is available now in the archives at Yale that offers a very rich and complex and interesting story.
How did he respond at the time to criticisms of what he had done?
He was very defensive, and as I say, with particularly any question that his subjects doubted the believability of the experiment, he dismissed out of hand. He also dismissed critics by saying that it was the power of his results and what he found that was so troubling for people, and that's why they had to deny what he was arguing. But privately, in his papers, he did agonise, and he was very conflicted about what he was doing to people involved in the research.
He must have also had defenders.
Absolutely.
Because he was confirming many people's ideas about human nature.
Very much so, and very much, too, confirming the importance of psychology as a science in showing us something deep and troubling that we would not have known otherwise. And he was very much part of a tradition in social psychology at that time that was looking for research that was counterintuitive and surprising. That was seen as a mark of good research. So we talk about blinkers. You can see that already he would be looking for research that would be would make an impact.
And who funded this research?
The National Science Foundation was the original funder of the research. Milgram applied for funding subsequent to that was unsuccessful.
My guest is Gina Perry, who is a psychologist and writer. She wrote the Australian Broadcasting Corporation's award-winning Radio National documentary called Beyond the Shock Machine. And now there is a book of that same title, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments, published by The New Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Gina Perry, who has written a book called Behind the Shock Machine, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments, published by The New Press. And as I mentioned earlier, there was a television documentary first.
Right.
How did you get involved in it, in doing this in the first place? Were you suspicious of the results of Milgram's research?
Far from it. No, I studied psychology, obviously, at university. I was a big admirer of Milgram's experiments, and I think a lot of people who studied psychology find the experiment intriguing and interesting, and it really does seem to reveal something profound about human nature. But I always felt that the subjects, really, their voices were missing from the story. So for me, I guess the Milgram experiment was always fascinating, but it ended for me before it began. I wanted to know what it was like for people when they left the lab, what they went home and said to their families about what had happened.
So you decided to do a documentary in which you talked to them.
I did a radio
and
documentary.
And what were they telling you?
Yes. I was very surprised with the first three or four people I spoke to for that documentary, because they were telling me things that were at odds with what I had read had happened in the experiment. So I thought, I need to go to the archives at Yale and really check my facts to make sure that I've got my information right. I mean, I could have... Initially, I thought perhaps people were misremembering, but their recall of detail of the experiment was so good that I really had to look again at the received story of the experiments.
Had anybody looked at the study in the files in depth before?
Milgram's biographers, Thomas Blass, had written a biography of Milgram in 2004, and he did some research in the archives, but there is so much material there. Each one of the 780 experiments is recorded on audio tape. There are files, there are folders, a wealth of information. It would have taken, and it did take, a long time to sift through it.
And did his biographer find anything to be suspicious of?
I don't think, in recalling that book, that he did particularly. I think he probably noticed that Milgram's description of what he told people when the experiment was over was a bit different. But I really had to go looking for information, so that was a bit more difficult.
Don't you find that a bit odd, considering the fact that the experiments have entered the popular culture with books, films, even a game show being based on them? There was a it was parodied on an early Simpsons episode, at the time of the experiments, the TV show Candid Camera was quite popular. People made the connection there, and yet nobody bothered to go in and actually look at the details of the experiments.
I guess there was no reason to, and until
we just accepted what he had
said. So until people, for example, told me that they challenged the experimenter during the experiment and told the experimenter that they thought it wasn't real. That was one person I interviewed told me that. Another person told me that when he left the lab, he went straight home to his neighbour, who was an electrician, and asked his neighbour to tell him what he might have just done. These things made me really wonder, well, what actually went on in that lab that is different from the official version? And once I started following up these kinds of comments the subjects had made, I realised there was a troubling mismatch between what had been published and what had actually happened.
So Milgram just simply skewed the results?
I wouldn't...
By leaving stuff out, you're kind of only telling half the story.
He certainly shaped the story of his experiments to come across as powerful and unequivocal. Whereas when you look at, for example, with the 24 different variations and the fact that the most well-known statistic is based on a sample of 40 people, and that we can guess that a number of those 40 were suspicious about whether or not a man was actually being hurt, it waters down significantly what it was that Milgram found in his lab and the conclusions that you can draw from that.
Well, you pointed out earlier that Milgram was actually looking to confirm his ideas about what had happened during the Holocaust and World War II. And then, of course, a little later we had the My Lai massacre, and people then referred back to Milgram's experiments to explain why people did that sort of thing. There were many other incidents that we could probably cite that would probably confirm what Milgram found.
I think the fact that we look for an analogy, or we look for an explanation of these events, and we reach for Milgram each time, strengthens the power of the story. And I think the Milgram research has taken on a life of its own in the public imagination that is quite different from the scientific story. In fact, Milgram's critics in the academic world, Milgram has been criticised and analysed and debated much more than it is in the public imagination. Most people remember Milgram as having found something difficult and troubling and conclusive. And yet, when you think about it, the 65% of 40 people doesn't tell us something about human nature. I think it tells us far more about what happened in a particular lab in 1961 and 62 in New Haven.
Well, you mentioned that some people doubted that this was really happening. But what about the ones who did believe? Were any of them traumatized by the experience?
Yes, a couple of people I spoke to, in fact, one of them who had broken off and disobeyed, was still traumatized by the fact that he'd even begun. So, yes, there were a proportion of people who underwent the experiment who were affected by it afterwards. And I think it's testament to the fact that they feel as strongly about it now as they did 50 years ago is evidence of that.
Didn't Milgram conduct a number of variations or conditions of the experiment?
Yes, there were 24, and each one had a separate script, different actors, and each of them tested different elements of the situation. So, for example, one variation, the teacher would arrive at the lab and go through the standard explanation, and then the experimenter would take a faked phone call and say, "I've been called away. You'll have to conduct the experiment on your own." Another one had another two teachers in the experiment who were egging on the naive subject to see how far he would go. So there were all these different variations, each of them having around 40 subjects in each of them.
To ascertain whether people would do this sort of thing on their own or whether they would respond to pressure.
What environmental and situational factors made it easier or harder for people to disobey? And I think it's very interesting that with Milgram's book and with all that we know about the experiments, the focus is on people who supposedly went to 450 voltage or allegedly went to 450 voltage. And yet I think what's so interesting is why we haven't done any much analysis at all of what is it that helps people resist.
Now, did Milgram publish the results of these variations, these other experiments?
He published the results of some of them, but I was surprised at Yale to find that he conducted a variation involving pairs of family members that was very disturbing to listen to. I listened to the audio tapes, the recordings of that experiment.
You mean people hurting their own family members with electric shocks?
Well, they thought they were fathers and sons, brothers-in-law. I mean, what's interesting is that it was such a low level of compliance. That could be one reason Milgram never published it. Another, I'm sure, would be because if you were trying to portray yourself as an ethical researcher, that would have been a very hard one to defend.
I wonder how the people who were acting shocked have thought about this over the years. Did you speak to any of them?
In the family member variation?
Or any of them, because they knew that they were faking it, but they knew that the other person was trying to hurt them with some pretty heavy electrical shocks.
I haven't spoken to the man who played the learner who was being shocked because he's died now, but I've spent a lot of time talking to his son. And what's interesting about the man who played the learner was he... In one of the audio tapes, he describes himself actually having heart palpitations during the experiment. And the story that I think is most fascinating is that sadly on the day that he died, he collapsed on the kitchen floor and his children ran across the road to get a neighbour who was a fireman to help resuscitate their father. And that man had been a subject in the experiment. So here he was... attempting to save his neighbour's life. And to me, that's the real test. Not what people do in a lab, but what motivates people to help one another in that.
Was he aware that they had had this other experience?
Was he aware that it was an experiment? Oh, yes, he was. He met his neighbour after the experiment was over. He met his neighbour in Milgram's lab. And still on the morning of the learner's heart attack, he raced across the road to give him CPR.
When you compare Milgram's unpublished findings with those he published, how does it change the results of the overall experiment?
Well, you can only really talk about the results of each individual variation. So we have some variations of the experiment. We have no people obedient at all. and we have others where it was as high as 65%. I think the experiment is described by Milgram, it's described as a highly standardised, a very scientific event. And when you look at the subject's point of view and you look at the unpublished material at Yale, it's clear that it was not a standardised and highly scientific. It was much more like theatre.
One of the surprises for me in this book is that in the course of researching it, you learned that the Milgram experiments had been reenacted in 1973 at your alma mater, La Trobe University in Australia.
Yes.
Had that been kept secret?
Well, yes. It was certainly not something that was well known at La Trobe when I went to find out about it a couple of years ago. But I had people get in touch with me when they heard about my Milgram research to say that they'd been part of the same experiment. In fact, it was part of undergraduate training at La Trobe University for 3 years in the early 1970s. Students had to conduct the Milgram experiment using acquaintances and friends, which is so ironic because it's actually very similar to the unpublished and secret experiment where Milgram used family members and friends. And I spoke to people, I've spoken to a number of those people who were involved in the La Trobe experiments, and they're still very, very upset, both the people who conducted it and the people who were recruited as subjects.
Well, what was the goal of trying to reenact the experiments if they only did it in a certain way? They didn't bring in strangers as Milgram had.
I think in certainly in psychology and at that time, before ethical constraints have made it difficult for these experiments to be repeated, there are a lot of people in the social psychological field who regard the Milgram experiments and that kind of theatrical illusion as very creative, inventive, and a way, the only real way that you can get at what people will do. Much like Candid Camera, that by hiding a camera somewhere and watching people covertly, you can actually see something that you might not otherwise see. So it's the drama of those experiments, it's the theatricality, and of course it's the sensational results that have given it such a power for so long.
In your opinion, has Milgram's work informed us or misinformed us about human nature and society?
I don't think it's informed us adequately at all because, as I said earlier, we've paid very little attention to what is it that helps people resist authority. We've paid very little attention to altruism, and I think we've paid too much attention to the story narrated by a scientist, and we need to look at why subjects' points of view have been so excluded from this kind of research.
What lessons can we take from Milgram's experiments in terms of what should not be allowed when we're experimenting on humans? Well, we don't administer drugs without knowing what kind of impact they're going to have, but this could be very destructive psychologically.
I think we need to really view people who take part in psychological research as people, not as subjects, which has a kind of connotation of objects. We refer now in psychological research to people as participants, so it implies there's a more equal relationship. The whole idea of viewing people's behaviour solely in an experiment, it's almost like looking at what a rat will do in a maze. But with humans, of course, you can ask them what they think and feel. So I think Milgram's experiments offers us a lot more in terms of what we can say about individual subjects' experiences. And I don't think Milgram's experiment has taught us much that has prevented things happening that could have been preventable.
Was Milgram's academic career damaged by the reaction to his writings and films?
He certainly was not offered tenure at Harvard when he went there after Yale. And yes, he moved to City University of New York subsequently and found it difficult to get funding for subsequent research. So that ambivalence about him persisted.
And is he no longer alive?
No, he died in 1984.
Gina Perry's book, Behind the Shock Machine, The Untold Story of the Notorious Milgram Psychology Experiments, is published by the New Press, and I thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.